which has to verify all these steps, says it could happen in January. Analyst Ali Vaez says that is possible. Mark Fitzpatrick says probably early February, more likely. But when it does happen, Iran will have access to more than $100 billion in unfrozen assets, banking restrictions lifted, as you said. In short, Iran will be much more of a player in the region and beyond in 2016.
Peter, let's remember there's lots of different political forces in Iran, not necessarily on the same page, many of them more conservative, and hated this deal. How are they responding now that it's being implemented, as far as we can tell?
There has been a hardline backlash for some time now, and it is heating up in part because we've got big parliamentary elections coming in about 8 weeks. It's an atmosphere in which everybody wants to be strong and patriotic, and now we have an issue involving missile testing that has President Hassan Rouhani, the pragmatist, siding with the conservatives. He's ordered his defense minister to speed up planning for producing even more missiles. That's in response to threatened U.S. sanctions. And that goes back to an October missile test that the U.N. says violated a Security Council resolution. So this is going to be a big battleground in Tehran and also for conservatives in Washington. We're just going to have to see if it affects the implementation of this nuclear deal.
And Peter will be tracking that. NPR's Peter Kenyon, thanks very much.
Thanks, Steve.
Today is implementation day of a different sort in California. A new fair pay law takes effect. It is meant to go beyond any other law in this country to ensure pay equity between men and women. Here's NPR's Laura Seidel.
Since 1949, equal pay for equal work has been the law in California. California State Senator Hannah Beth Jackson says many women are doing the same work as their male counterparts, but have a different job title and they make less. Jackson says the new law will make it much more difficult for employers to continue to do this.
It will ensure that women are paid equally for substantially similar work to their male colleagues.
One example Jackson cites is hotel housekeepers, who are mostly women. They are paid less than janitors, who are largely men.
How is this job so much more different that we should be paying that man, the janitor, more than the housekeeper?
These are the kinds of questions that employers around California are being forced to ask as they prepare for the new law to take effect. Elaine Reardon of the economic consulting firm Resolution Economics has been working with many California companies. She says it's not always clear what kinds of jobs are comparable. So if the women at a bakery do more of the administrative work and the men are the bakers.
So does the fact that the administrative position requires more, perhaps, in the way of computer skills, counteract the fact that working in a bakery, you have to work with very hot ovens? You know, are these offsetting?
And there may be legitimate reasons for a pay difference, says employment attorney Jeffrey Dabosky.
So it is, of course, not against the law necessarily to pay two people differently. But what the law looks at is whether or not it's based upon a bona fide business reason.
Dabosky says many of his clients are doing deep evaluations of their workforce. They're looking at how pay differences may have occurred in the first place. For example, if a job requires travel and women are more often stuck taking care of children.
That may create a situation where women are not able to achieve in a position to the same degree as a male colleague.
Dabosky says some of his clients are trying to find ways to better accommodate childcare issues so that women are able to be more productive and to ultimately equalize pay. And while these kinds of regulations often are opposed by businesses, the new Fair Pay Act was endorsed by the California Chamber of Commerce and passed with bipartisan support. And now many other states across the country are watching what happens with interest to see if California's new law helps close a persistent pay gap between men and women. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
This new year offers a new chance for many states to head off drug addiction. Americans are dying from overdoses of prescription opioids and heroin at levels never seen before. NPR's Arun Roth reports on what many states are trying now.
First, let's start with something we know is going to happen in 2016. More diversion. As an approach to solving the opioid problem, diversion means diverting addicts from the criminal justice system to the healthcare system. For Leonard Noisette, the increasing acceptance of diversion signals a final reframing of the war on drugs.
I think that the country has gotten to a place where there's widespread recognition that the war on drugs and the attempt to use the justice system, and particularly incarceration, as a response to drug use and drug misuse was a mistake.
Noisette is the program director of the Justice Fund at Open Society Foundations. They've been supporting law enforcement assisted diversion programs across the country. And in 2016, they'll be funding programs in 7 new cities.
Law enforcement assisted diversion is an attempt to get law enforcement officials and the public at large to think that a law enforcement person who's encountering such a situation might have other alternatives instead of arresting the person and putting that person into the court system.
Whether it's shifting a burden from the criminal justice system to the healthcare system, or public institutions like police forces working with private foundations like Open Society, the blurring of institutional lines seems to be a sign of the times when it comes to the opioid crisis. Carmen Hansen is a program manager with the National Conference of State Legislatures.
I've been working on health policy for about 15 years, and I honestly can't think of anything other than the Affordable Care Act that has touched so many other aspects of policy and state legislation.
And she doesn't expect it to calm down in 2016.
My guess is there's going to be some type of bill to address prescription drug abuse and opiate abuse at some level for every state.
In the criminal justice system, in addition to diversion, increasing numbers of states are revising mandatory sentencing policies and criminal penalties for some drug offenses. Other measures include Good Samaritan laws that let people seek medical attention for overdoses without fear of arrest, and making anti-overdose drug naloxone easier to obtain. Many places in many states have adopted these practices, and in 2016, many more are poised to do so. Carmen Hansen says states are looking at what other states are doing and copying the best ideas.
And if you're looking for ideas and sharing what works, that's what they're interested in right now.
Meanwhile, in Massachusetts, where many of the ideas laid out here are already policy, for 2016, Governor Charlie Baker has proposed a couple of alternative approaches that have not been tried before and are generating some controversy. One would limit a first-time prescription for opiate painkillers to a 72-hour supply. The Massachusetts Medical Society put out a statement raising concern the limit could undermine a doctor's clinical judgment. Here's Governor Baker.
But they came back a couple weeks later and said, well, for first prescriptions for opioids, given everything that's going on, maybe 7 days would be fine. So my proposal is 3 days, theirs is 7. We're clearly heading, I think, to some sort of agreement on that.
The other controversial proposal actually gives some doctors more power. It would allow emergency doctors to hospitalize addicts against their will for up to 72 hours. That doesn't sit well with many civil liberties advocates. But Baker points out the proposal has been endorsed by the Massachusetts Association of Community Hospitals.
I think a lot of folks in the healthcare community know that not taking some controversial steps here and doing some things to disrupt the status quo, we're not going to disrupt the status quo, and we need to disrupt the status quo.
If these proposals become law in Massachusetts this year, one thing is certain. Other states will be watching closely to see if they work. Arun Roth, NPR News, Boston.
Always ready to disrupt your status quo. It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
And you're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 8:18. Coming up on the show, as homeowners install solar panels and make their own power, electric utilities are making less money. We examine how utilities in two different states, California and Georgia, are handling this. And California is finally getting some good news about the drought. The water content of the Sierra Nevada snowpack in California was more than 100% above average this week. Those stories coming up in just a few minutes.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the author of Cracked Not Broken, Surviving and Thriving After a Suicide Attempt will speak at Racine's Infozino's Thursday evening, January 21st. For more information about the discussion and accompanying dinner, contact the 21st Century Prep School.
Family Entertainment. Wisconsin Public Radio is pleased to support cultural connections from across the globe. More information at WPR.org/events.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nancy Lyons. President Obama says his New Year's resolution is to take steps to make it harder for a dangerous few to get their hands on guns. In his weekly address, he says he'll meet with Attorney General Loretta Lynch Monday to discuss possible executive actions he could take.
I get too many letters from parents and teachers and kids to sit around and do nothing.
One insider says the president is expected to take executive action next week that would set a reasonable threshold for when sellers have to seek a background check.
The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in Northern California has refused to block a new California law requiring religious-sponsored anti-abortion clinics to notify patients that the state offers reproductive health services, including abortion, at little or no cost. Attorneys for three abortion clinics contend the required notification violates their clients' freedom of speech rights. Bob Hensley explains what the clinics wanted.
The clinics had asked the panel to issue an injunction delaying implementation of the law, thus giving their attorneys time to challenge its constitutionality. The appeals court denied the request. An attorney representing the clinics vowed to continue fighting to have the law overturned.
Hawaii today becomes the first state to raise its minimum age to buy or use cigarettes from 18 to 21. Local governments have taken such action, but never a state. I'm Nancy Lyons, NPR News in Washington.
And this is news from Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Noah Ovshinsky. Wisconsin is battling the U.S. government in three lawsuits that could be decided before the end of next year. In all three, the state is challenging the right of the federal government to supersede state-enacted regulations. Gilman Halstead reports.
One of the lawsuits challenges the Environmental Protection Agency's new clean power rules that impose new limits on emissions from coal-fired power plants. Wisconsin and 25 other states are trying to block the new restrictions, claiming they will cripple their local economies. Wisconsin and 18 other states are also suing the EPA over new clean water rules that impose federal regulations on navigable waters, superseding state rules already in place. In the third case, the state is challenging the right of the U.S. Department of Agriculture to bar the state from drug testing food stamp recipients. The state claims its new law conforms with a 1996 federal law that allows the tests. Environmental protection and welfare advocates are hoping that federal law prevails in all three cases. Gilman Halstead, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And snowmobilers were out in force in Vilas County on New Year's Eve after the trails had been open the day before. The recent snowstorm made that possible, though conditions aren't ideal. More than 500 miles of trails in the county are open, and snowmobilers have been waiting. The opening comes about 1 month later than usual. Riders are being told to be extra cautious because there's only about 6 inches of snow on the ground. This is WPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations. And from CarMax, a nationwide retailer of used vehicles, where people can buy or sell their car, offering written vehicle appraisals good for 7 days. Learn more at CarMax.com. CarMax, the bright side of car buying. From the estate of Eric Robert Gustafson, member of the graduating class of 1955 from Lincoln High School in Seattle, whose bequest seeks to help NPR further its mission to work with member stations to create a more informed public. And from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting Wikipedia and the Digital Public Library of America through its Universal Access to Knowledge program, working to facilitate the openness and accessibility of all knowledge at sloan.org.
On New Year's morning, it's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. 2015 was a record year for rooftop solar power sales. That means more homeowners are making their own power. It also means electric utilities are making less money. Solar has become extensive enough that some utilities see a threat to their business models. Today we have reports on how utilities in two states are handling this. Lauren Summer from member station KQED starts in California.
There's a certain kind of Californian who's making electric utilities very nervous.
That's the pasta.
This is pasta.
That's right.
That's Matt Brown, and he's getting dinner ready for his two young boys.
Daddy, can I have one more?
Yes, you can.
Brown recently got solar panels on his Oakland home, but it's dark out right now. His panels aren't working. So Brown's appliances are running on electricity he's buying from his utility, Pacific Gas and Electric. So even with solar panels, you might think his utility bill is pretty high.
Right now, we're projected basically to have a zero bill.
$0. That's because during the day, when Brown's panels are cranking out electricity, he sells the extra back to PG&E. The power he sells cancels out the power he buys. That's what makes solar so financially attractive, at least for him.
It is going to be a challenge for the utility.
That's Aaron Johnson, a vice president at PG&E. The utility is home to a quarter of all the rooftop solar systems in the country, and a new one comes online every 7 minutes. And to handle that, he says, today's electric grid needs an upgrade.
as we begin to build that sort of modern 21st century grid, you know, everyone's going to have to contribute to that. And we think solar customers need to contribute to that.
Did you catch that last part? He's saying with their low bills, solar customers aren't pitching in enough. That's creating a shortfall that PG&E says will reach almost $3 billion a year within a decade. So California's utilities want to pay new solar customers less for their extra electricity and add new monthly fees.
That argument can only come from a monopoly that is used to selling every electron to every customer for the past 100 years.
Walker Wright works at Sunrun, one of the largest solar companies in the country.
What rooftop solar represents is the first true form of competition.
Wright sees the proposed fees as a direct attack on the solar industry. The same thing happened in Arizona, where a utility recently started charging their solar customers $50 a month.
We saw a 95% drop in the applications for solar. We saw, you know, absolute devastation in the market, and it's created a lot of anxiety.
That's not something California wants to do, Wright argues, when the state has big renewable energy goals. Whatever California regulators decide, the state makes up more than 40% of the country's solar market. So the precedent set here could spread nationwide, says Brian Chin. He analyzes utilities for Merrill Lynch.
A lot of times these states all kind of look at each other and go, well, if they can do that and it's reasonable, then we can do it too.
Chin says it just shows how solar is disrupting the way electric utilities do business.
You look at sort of the business model and you can't help but go, the business model has to change in the next 15 years in some way, shape, or form.
That's why utilities in some other states are trying a different approach to solar.
Like in Georgia. I'm Molly Samuel from member station WABE in Atlanta. And here, Georgia Power, which is the biggest utility in the state, is getting into the rooftop solar game itself. The company will evaluate your house to see if you're a good candidate for solar panels, and it'll even get them installed for you.
In case our customers do want to add rooftop solar, we want to be there to sell it to them.
Jacob Hawkins is a spokesman with Georgia Power. It just launched the rooftop part of its business about 6 months ago. But in general, unlike some other utilities, Georgia Power isn't acting like rooftop solar panels are a threat.
We look at it not as necessarily something brand new, but an evolution of something that we've always done.
Now, there are a few important differences between Georgia and California when it comes to solar. Electricity costs less here, so it makes less financial sense for people to get rooftop solar panels. When they do have solar panels on the roofs, the utility doesn't pay as much to buy the extra energy generated as it would in California. But solar is growing here.
I believe Georgia Power's made great strides.
Jason Rooks is a lobbyist in Georgia for the Solar Energy Industries Association. He says just a few years ago,
I remember down at the Capitol hearing that, you know, solar won't work in Georgia because it's too cloudy. It's, you know, too much humidity in Georgia. And then, of course, it was too expensive.
He says that mood started to shift thanks in part to the Georgia Public Service Commission, which regulates utilities. Tim Eccles is one of the commissioners.
When I ran for office, I promised to try solar myself.
He says that taught him a few things.
With the first lesson being, don't put solar on a house in the shade.
Eccles says the commission brought Georgia Power to the table and directed the company to add more solar power, especially with solar farms. But Eccles wasn't in any rush to do that.
Our commission is all Republican, and we wanted to make sure this would work financially.
That all means the state's been slow to adopt solar, especially rooftop solar. Lobbyist Jason Rook says that's not necessarily been a bad thing.
In hindsight, there's a benefit to that, even as a solar advocate, that we haven't had the trial and error of early adoption.
Solar is still pretty tiny here. It accounts for about 1% of all the energy generated in the state. And rooftop solar panels instead of large solar farms are only a tiny percentage of that. But there's a lot of potential. And with the utility here embracing rooftop solar, they may be forging a different path than states like California. For NPR News, I'm Molly Samuel in Atlanta.
Californians hope they're nearing the end of a 5-year drought. A new survey finds the snowpack is higher than normal in the Sierra Nevada mountain range. Those snow-covered mountainsides become the source for much of the water that flows down to the coast. Scientist Jay Lund sees this as a good sign.
It's much better than last year, but it's still early days.
He's director of the Center for Watershed Sciences at the University of California, Davis. And he says it's still early days because heavy snowfall would have to continue for months to get back to normal. The El Nino weather system could also help.
It'll take quite a few large storms. We have a very large cumulative deficit over the last 4 years, both in reservoirs and in groundwater storage, but it'll take a real gully washer.
Which has not yet happened.
there's always this promise of El Nino. So we're hopeful that we'll get more rain, but we haven't seen it yet.
For now, Lund says he welcomes the snowpack results. California will pretty much take water in any form. This is NPR News.
In the new film Concussion, a doctor stands up to the NFL after research shows a possible link between football and a type of brain disease. The movie shines more light on the dangers of repeated head trauma, but players off the screen say that won't keep them from the game.
Having to protect myself is definitely a thought that's on my mind, but it's something that I can't play with.
Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Steve Inskeep. Green Bay, Wisconsin kicked off the new year by parading a llama downtown. Why a llama, you ask? Well, Mayor Jim Schmidt explained to TV station WBAY.
Legend has it that if you view this llama on New Year's Eve, good things will come your way the following year.
Having said that, Mayor Schmidt confessed it's all made up. He just wants to start a new tradition, and he prefers the llama to Green Bay's other option, a giant illuminated cheese head. It's Morning Edition.
And you're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:31. Coming up, it's prediction time when we talk about what's ahead for the new year. Claudio Sanchez of the NPR Ed team has been looking into his crystal ball to see where things are going on testing, affirmative action, and other issues for the nation's schools and colleges. That story coming up in just a few minutes.
Morning Edition. Classical music. Wisconsin life. These programs and many more are possible thanks to listener support. You can learn more about WPR programs, schedules, and so much more at WPR.org. Thank you.
Support for WGTD's Radio Theater comes from the Lakelawn Resort in Delavan, a full-service leisure getaway, family retreat, and meeting facility. Lakelawn Resort, a proud supporter of WGTD's Radio Theater. LakelawnResort.com.
Beethoven's Ninth Symphony is considered to be one of the greatest works in all of Western art. And it takes on special significance when it's performed by Wisconsin classical musicians. Enjoy the Madison Symphony Orchestra's 2015 performance this Sunday at 1 as we begin a new year of Wisconsin classical performances on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Taking a look at the weather forecast for today, mostly cloudy in the morning, then becoming partly cloudy. We've got some isolated flurries in the forecast throughout the state with highs in the lower to mid-20s. Tonight, partly cloudy. Those isolated flurries expected to continue with lows down into the teens. And for tomorrow, partly cloudy with highs in the mid to upper 20s. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. From the estate of Miles Gatterman, whose bequest is a tribute to NPR's ongoing dedication to music and the arts. And from the Simons Foundation, working to advance research in basic science and mathematics. More information is available online at simonsfoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. Let's ask what happens in the new year in education now that a national education law has changed. The No Child Left Behind law has been left behind. So has federally mandated types of tests that students take across the country. So what happens next? NPR education reporter Claudio Sanchez, part of our Ed team, spoke with us about what to expect in 2016.
Well, what's coming is a huge and sweeping change in how the federal government oversees public schools. The long, grueling fight over the 14-year-old No Child Left Behind law is over. But that will turn out to be the easy part. The new law returns most government oversight of schools back to states with no guarantee that they will succeed where No Child Left Behind failed, closing the achievement gap, raising the performance of the absolute worst schools. So we will see less testing, probably, but we're going to see reading and math scores drop for all kinds of reasons, tougher standardized tests, namely. The dismal performance, though, of low-income minority children will trigger much more scrutiny from civil rights groups in 2016. They're going to organize like never before to pressure states to deal also with teacher quality and funding.
So this battle that's been taking place in the federal level moves to the states. And then there's another battle that involves both the federal government and the states over Common Core, these standards across the country that have been so controversial. What happens there?
Well, the controversy over the much maligned Common Core standards will wane in 2016. Most states will finish rebranding and quietly adopting the Common Core.
Rebranding? What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is we've already seen a lot of states just rename the Common Core standards. Indiana is a perfect example. They have renamed their standards Hoosier standards.
This is the state that dropped very publicly Common Core a couple of years ago, so now they're going to continue in a different form.
That's right. What people are saying, though, about the Common Core is that even if, whatever you call them, that there's not going to be a so-called race to the bottom as we once saw under No Child Left Behind. We're actually seeing all 50 states raise their standards, and that's a good thing.
What about charter schools?
Charter schools are going to celebrate their 25th anniversary in 2016. There are 6,700 schools and nearly 3 million students in 43 states. That's huge. Charters, by the way, Steve, often function as parallel school systems in some places. The federal government has poured billions of dollars into charters for the past 20 years. The polling shows that a majority of Americans support them. But charter schools will increasingly come under fire from an unexpected critic, presidential candidate Hillary Clinton. Despite her longtime support of charters, she's blasted them for not taking what she calls the hardest to teach kids, especially those with learning disabilities. This is, by the way, an accusation that teachers' unions have been making for years, and they're going to make more forcefully in 2016. It also means that charters may very well make it into the presidential campaign debate.
Well, what are the presidential candidates saying about higher education?
Well, higher education, of course, is another huge issue. Higher education leaders, for example, scrapped or at least opposed and pretty much defeated a proposal by the Obama administration to create a more transparent way for parents to decide what schools are best, which schools are the best buy. And Senator Marco Rubio, who has denounced the higher education community and calls it the higher ed cartel, has been adamant about exposing what he feels is the abuse of higher education in terms of cost, in terms of transparency. So he's after them. But here's one thing that's going to go on in 2016 as part of the presidential debate. The whole discussion about tuition-free and debt-free college is really going to raise the political heat on higher education because parents are just fed up with what they're getting for what they're paying and the fact that they're having to borrow so much more money to pay for their kids' college education.
That's Claudio Sanchez of NPR's Ed Team. Thanks for the forecast.
You're welcome.
Scientists are still trying to educate themselves about a substance they cannot see. It's called dark matter. Physicists are certain that dark matter makes up most of the mass of the universe. They're sure of that, even though they can't seem to find it. NPR's Joe Palca, the reporter of our series, Joe's Big Idea, has been asking what makes scientists certain.
One reason scientists are so sure dark matter has to exist is that they can see the effect it's having on the way stars and galaxies are moving. Without something providing the gravity to hold the stars in as the galaxy rotates, the stars would fly off into space like a bunch of dishes flying off a spinning Lazy Susan. Richard Gateskell is a physicist at Brown University.
If you look at a typical galaxy and count up all the stars in the galaxy, which is perfectly possible for us to do this day, you find that the speed at which that galaxy rotates is simply too fast to be held together by the mass of those stars alone.
Gateskell says if you calculate how much gravity is needed to hold a galaxy together,
you find that 90% of the matter of that galaxy has to be some other dark material, which is why we don't see it in our telescopes.
Once scientists were convinced dark matter had to exist, they quickly realized dark matter couldn't be something familiar, like clouds of interstellar soot. So they looked for something more exotic, using giant particle accelerators and sensitive detectors, and found nothing.
It cannot be a conventional particle that we already know about. That, of course, makes it so fascinating is because it has to be new physics.
Gaitskell says most scientists are now convinced that what makes dark matter so devilishly hard to pin down is it just doesn't interact with anything, even though there's a lot of it all around us all the time. And I mean a lot. Gaitskell says right now, if you stick out your hand...
You've probably got about 100 million dark matter particles going through your hand every second.
And none of them, not one, will leave any trace.
You could have your hand out for a century and still not have a single dark matter particle interact with it.
But Gaitskell says theory predicts at some point one of these particles will interact with something. The question is,
can we build an instrument that is sensitive enough to actually get the first signal?
More than a dozen teams around the world are trying. Gaitskell leads one of the efforts. It's called LUX, the Large Underground Xenon Experiment. 815 pounds of liquid xenon in a tank festooned with detectors in an abandoned gold mine in South Dakota, waiting for a dark matter particle to have one of those rare interactions. So far, nothing. A much bigger detector is planned for later in this decade. I asked Gaitskell if it ever gets frustrating to keep coming up empty. Wouldn't he prefer to work on something with a higher chance of success? No, he said.
Even a small chance at ushering in this new generation of our understanding of both cosmology and at the same time fundamental particle physics, that's too good an opportunity to pass up.
Well, you can't blame a guy for trying. Joe Palca, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
And you're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:41. Coming up in 10 minutes on the Marketplace Morning Report, today is the deadline for all branches of the military to turn in their plans for how women will be fully integrated into all roles, including combat positions. A look at how this update will change the perception of women in the armed services. That story coming up in just about 10 minutes.
Hi, I'm Mike Crane, director of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'd like to thank the 52,000 individuals and families who gave in the past year. On air and increasingly online, you and your entire community turned to WPR for the best news coverage around, inspiring music, and important discussions. And it's all possible because of your support. Thank you, and we look forward to serving you in 2016.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nancy Lyons. No known cause yet for a fire yesterday that charred a portion of the high-rise Address Hotel in Dubai. Becky Anderson with CNN International spoke with NPR's Morning Edition.
Smoke still billowing from what is this luxury hotel in downtown Dubai. Today's firefighters or civil defense squads, as they're known here, continue what is the process of cooling down this smoldering building.
The fire started last night before a New Year's fireworks display. Rwandan President Paul Kagame is seeking a third term in office, thanks to a constitutional referendum that could allow him to stay in power until 2034. Kagame made the announcement during a New Year's address, and as the BBC's Tommy Oladipo reports, Kagame also noted he did not believe the country needed an eternal leader.
In a televised address, President Kagame was keen to highlight that it was the people of Rwanda who wanted him back in power. Given the importance and consideration you attach to this, I can only accept, he said. But he added that he did not want to be president for life, saying someone else would succeed him sooner rather than later.
Kagame has been president since 2000. Two people are dead, three others wounded following a shooting in central Tel Aviv. Israeli police say the motive is unclear. A manhunt is underway for the shooter, who quickly fled after taking out a machine gun and shooting in every direction. I'm Nancy Lyons, NPR News in Washington.
And this is news from Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Noah Ovshinsky. The state assembly could soon pass a bill to repeal Wisconsin's moratorium on new nuclear power plants. But as Sean Johnson reports, the plan's future is murky in the Senate.
Assembly Speaker Robin Vaughn says he wants the full assembly to pass the bill in January. He says federal regulations are making coal-fired power more expensive, so Wisconsin needs to explore other options.
We've got to figure out a way to produce energy because we are so dependent on it in Wisconsin with manufacturing.
The bill passed an assembly committee 13-0, but it's unlikely to receive that much bipartisan support in the Senate, where Democratic Minority Leader Jen Schilling says some of her members have concerns over nuclear waste.
Until we have a place where we can deposit the waste in a safe place, that just doesn't seem to be a responsible alternative right now.
Senate Republican Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald says he's open to lifting the nuclear moratorium, but he says it's not a top priority. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And police are investigating a crash involving first responders in Milwaukee. An ambulance, squad car, and pickup truck collided Thursday morning near downtown. WISN-TV reports a police officer had minor injuries, and the pickup driver was taken to the hospital as a precaution. Police say the officer was responding to a nearby shooting when the crash occurred. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Noah Ovshinsky. The time is 8:45.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Embry Family Foundation, working to expand awareness, explore possibilities, and elevate consciousness through philanthropy and community building. From the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the belief that investing in women and children today ensures a healthy, prosperous future for everyone. More information is available at gatesfoundation.org. And from the estate of Miles Gatterman, whose bequest is a tribute to NPR's ongoing dedication to music and the arts.
And it's time for Wisconsin Life. Nearly everyone collects something. For Middleton's Gary Brockman, it's buttons. He tells us what he loves about these everyday fasteners and the deep human history that can be read on their face.
I've collected a lot of things across my life, but I can't think of another type of object that pulls together the loose threads of sociology and art history and material science and technology in such a complete way as buttons do. Early 90s, I was working in publishing in New York, and long story short, I needed some buttons for a workshop we were going to do with science teachers, and did the workshop. There happened to be two people who were button collectors in that group of science teachers, and once the buttons went out on the table, the science portion of the workshop was over for them. I just sidled around to where they were owing and awing over them and asked them what was going on, and they told me they were button collectors and these were really wonderful buttons, and I asked them if they would stay around after the workshop ended and just tell me about them, and they did, and I was hooked from that point on. There is, of course, the Midwestern shell button industry. Most of the shell buttons that came out of Wisconsin waters were utilitarian. They were fairly plain. They might have a little bit of decorative carving. But there were also outfits that would cut blanks, just cut discs from the shells, and then ship them to Europe for finishing, for cameo carving and other modes of tooling that would produce very deluxe buttons. So in some cases, the utilitarian buttons went directly to market from Wisconsin. In other cases, Wisconsin was one link in a supply chain that included Europe. Button collecting has had a couple of different iterations. It was very popular during the Victorian era. As an organized hobby in the United States, it really dates back to the late 1930s. The publisher of Hobbies Magazine in Chicago was instrumental in putting together a group of people who wanted to form a national button society, which still exists and which every few years has its national convention here in Wisconsin. I think buttons matter in the way that any material from any culture at any point in history matters. They're windows into our past. You know, there's that really tired old saying, those who forget their history are condemned to repeat it. And this is just one more avenue into human history, into cultural history, into technological history. You've got it all right here. You can see the development of artistic styles. You can see the development of manufacturing techniques. Everything is connected to everything else.
K Gary Brockman is a button collector and dealer. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit our website at wisconsinlife.org and find us on Facebook. The time is now 8:50. The music starts at 9, and today's highlights include ceremonial pieces for brass and a flute concerto. Then at 10, it's the annual New Year's Day concert with the Vienna Philharmonic. Join Stephanie Elkins for Morning Classics in 10 minutes, right after the Marketplace Morning Report, which is next here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support comes from Gateway, offering pathways to high-in-demand IT jobs that include network security and software and web development, starting pay $50,000 to $70,000 a year. 1-800-247-7122. Choose option 2 and ask for a new student specialist.
Or radical robots and gadgets galore. Wisconsin Public Radio is pleased to support science exploration and education. For more information, visit wpr.org/events.
Taking a look at the weather forecast for today, mostly cloudy in the morning, then becoming partly cloudy. We're expecting some isolated flurries throughout the state with highs in the lower to mid-20s. Tonight, partly cloudy. Those isolated flurries expected to continue with lows in the teens. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thank you to the business sponsors who help support WPR programs, including Overture Center for the Arts, Union Cab Cooperative, and Kimberly-Clark Corporation. Play a role in the success of WPR. Go to wpr.org/sponsor.
Support for WGTD's Radio Theater comes from the Lake Lawn Resort in Delavan, a full-service leisure getaway, family retreat, and meeting facility. Lake Lawn Resort, a proud supporter of WGTD's Radio Theater. LakeLawnResort.com.
That was crude oil leaving by ship from the U.S. to a foreign destination yesterday. That is news.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From Marketplace in New York, I'm David Brancaccio. In the last 24 hours, the first tanker of U.S. crude oil destined for export departed a U.S. port under new legislation ending the long-standing export ban. It embarked from the port of Corpus Christi, with the Wall Street Journal identifying it as a ConocoPhillips and NuStar Energy cargo. The oil was pulled from the shale formation called Eagle Ford in South Texas. The industry argued there was plenty of crude to allow exports without hurting U.S. prices. Barbara Shook with the Energy Intelligence Group says refineries supplying the U.S. market are set up for their own supplies.
You'll have a little more swapping around here and there. Refineries can't overnight change the feedstock grades that they can use. It's as if an oven in the kitchen could cook only a certain recipe. And the U.S. is going to be exporting light sweet crudes, but most of the refineries in the world anymore are configured to operate on medium to heavy grades because that was how the world was configured until the shale gale in the U.S.
Catch that phrase, shale gale. Oil traded in New York will start the year at around $37 a barrel, down 30% from a year ago. While past performance is not a guide to the future, we can now calculate that the NASDAQ composite, filled with so many technology stocks, went up 5.7% in the year just ended. While past performance is no future guide, the S&P 500 fell 0.7% last year, the first annual drop since 2008, although that year of the financial collapse was vastly worse for the S&P. It fell 37% in that year. The Dow Jones Industrial Average in 2015 fell 2.1%. More money is in bonds than stocks. As for those vast markets, let's check in with Guy Labat, Chief Fixed Income Strategist with Janney Montgomery Scott.
Yeah, some people talk about bull markets, others about bear markets. And for bonds, at least, this was the hamster market. They kind of ran around and around and ultimately went nowhere. And we're finishing the year with at least long-term interest rates pretty close to where we started. And the reason really is that the financial markets came around to believing this concept called secular stagnation. And secular stagnation refers to an economic trend whereby economic growth is slow for a very long period for reasons we basically can't fix, such as slower population growth, for example.
And how is it possible that the benchmark interest rate, the 10-year Treasury yield, ended up by less than 0.1% over the past year, given all the noise about higher interest rates to come? Labov says that's partly because the noise has been going on for so long, and that rate hike last month was already priced in. This new year is the deadline for all branches of the U.S. military to turn in their detailed plans for how women will be fully integrated into all roles, including combat positions. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports.
Starting tomorrow, the military will slowly be opening up all jobs to women, which means all the pay grades are opening up too. Catherine Kidder is a fellow at the Center for New American Security, a military-focused think tank.
On the whole, the military has actually been a really good equalizer when it comes to current compensation.
That's because there's a pretty straightforward method of determining pay. Years of service, what job you're doing, where, and how dangerous it is. But there are other kinds of wage disparity.
And the fact that women have historically and continue to be shut out of some occupations means that they make lower wages than they should.
Fatima Goss-Graves is with the National Women's Law Center. She says blocking women from certain combat designations also blocked better pay and benefits. But now that's changing.
This is going to be big, not just for the military.
She says this will challenge perceptions about what jobs women can do, both in and out of the armed services. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
The huge 700-member Allen High School Band from North Texas is among those marching in today's Rose Parade in Pasadena. But who fixes all those expensive horns and tubas if they get banged up out there on the road? Bowie High School in Arlington, Texas, recently launched a program to teach young people how to repair instruments. Bill Zeeble with KERA in Dallas reports.
Joe Stroll puts a battered silver-plated baritone horn on the work table and hands me a hammer.
Good. Beautiful.
Almost done.
All right.
Stroll teaches instrument repair, and he says don't feel bad. This horn's a volunteer.
We've done quite a bit of repair. This is actually one of our demo horns that we get to do this sort of thing on.
Now with new damage, this horn will teach dent removal. It was among $60,000 worth of new instruments donated by the Yamaha company. Roger Eaton is Yamaha's chief marketing director.
We get instruments that are freight damaged. We get instruments that... stuff happens.
These instruments help students learn to make them sing. Repair expert Stroll comes borrowed from Music and Arts, a Maryland-based band instrument retailer. He tells 17-year-old student Noah Patrick that brass dents are among the most common problems. He remembers one mom who brought in her son's trombone.
She picked it up off the bed, stuck it up in the air, and the trombone slide caught in the ceiling fan and just bent it into a 90-degree angle. That was a new experience.
This class is a new experience for Patrick.
Honestly, school's just not really my thing. I've always liked kind of building stuff and putting it together. And since I love music, I figure, why not do this?
Jeremy Earnhardt with Arlington Schools came up with this program.
It's like blacksmithing, and it takes a number of years. So after 2 years with this program with Music and Arts, our students will be apprenticeship ready.
And Earnhardt says that instrument repair techs can make up to $70,000 a year. And there's a market for bringing instruments back into shape, like that horn I hammered. Stroll shows me what it can do after a little work.
We got it to the point where it is playable.
The current generation of instrument repair techs is aging. Without ready replacements, it's the industry that could be singing the blues. In Arlington, Texas, I'm Bill Zeeble for Marketplace.
And before we go, implicit in copyright law is the ability of the rights holder to say, no, I don't want this published anywhere. So it has been with the copyright to Adolf Hitler's book Mein Kampf, that hateful, muddled, anti-Semitic screed. After the war, the government of the German state of Bavaria was given the rights, and Bavaria said no to anyone who wanted to reprint that book. But it's been 70 years, and the copyright has now expired. The BBC's reporting that some Jewish groups are now supporting a new Mein Kampf volume with academic annotations that will explore how Hitler's book went so wrong. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
And you've been listening to the Marketplace Morning Report on Wisconsin Public Radio. It is a minute before 9 o'clock. Coming up, it's Morning Classics with Stephanie Elkins. In the weather forecast for today, mostly cloudy in the morning, then becoming partly cloudy with some flurries expected, and highs in the 20s. This is WPR.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio is provided by the Harold A. and Helen D. Engel Fund, helping to keep educational information available to communities throughout the state by providing support for Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television.
Support comes from Kenosha Winter Harbor Market. The market opens Saturdays during the cold weather season, and the atrium of the Rohde Center for the Arts in downtown Kenosha is currently on break. It'll reopen Saturday, January 9th. For more, visit KenoshaHarborMarket.com. You're listening to WGT.